Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing kind of a little bit of a hodgepodge of what's been a major topic right now, what I think will be a major topic this year, and that is the empathy debate. And I think evangelicalism and perhaps the broader culture is going to be debating this topic, this concept, as it's been used, as it's been misused, and I think this is a positive development overall, but we're going to get into an article by Christian Post, which takes a very firm stance on this issue, and it's a very feminist article, so I think it's going to be pretty interesting from that point of view as well. But with a couple of major books coming out, we got Ali Stuckey's Toxic Empathy that's already come out. I think it came out like late last year, October-ish. And then we have Joe Rigney's The Sin of Empathy. And so I've kind of combined those two in the article. As a disclaimer, I've not yet read either book, but I have ordered Joe Rigney's book, but it's not arrived yet. It may be just released this year, or maybe it's just releasing today. I kind of can't remember. I haven't checked Amazon. I've had a lot going on lately, so I don't know about you. Like, yesterday was actually the height of my professional career. At least so far, it might be the most impactful single day as far as my working career goes. But today was more like a surprise, and you know, I'm kind of feeling the weight of things as far as stress goes. I don't know about you, Anthony.
No, it's been.
I've heard you've had some high times.
More just confirmation of things I've already gotten. You know, it's been a lot of money coming in because you know tax season plus you know. Stuff in the workplace. So yeah, a lot of good, financial stuff, a nice little financial windfall is coming.
Yeah. I definitely felt that way. It definitely paid to file taxes as soon as I could, which was last Monday. And surprisingly, I got like the refunds really quickly. I was surprised that Maryland gave the refund like within days.
Hey, look,
usually that stuff takes like a couple of weeks.
I was just glad that they owed me money this time. Because last year it was $5. I owed $5 on taxes, which is the most ridiculous amount. Well, maybe not the most ridiculous amount, but yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. But
yeah. So that's basically my latest. I think it'll also be my like last year of using TurboTax. So I guess good problem. So anyway, that's just a little update because I did tell people in like several live streams ago at this point, like back in January, it's like, hey, I quit my day job, you know, to pursue working for myself and stuff like that. And yesterday that stuff finally came into fruition. And today was kind of like another, I guess we're significant progress was made, but it's also kind of a weird transitioning time that's begun for not just me anymore. So a lot of stuff happening. So with that said, we're going to dive into tonight's topic, which is again going to be about the whole concept of empathy and the debate that's surrounding it. I kind of wanted to use a Christian Post article to kind of get us started on this, because this article, I sent it to you ahead of time.
Yeah, it's a dumpster fire.
It is a dumpster fire, but it's also a familiar dumpster fire.
An arsonist?
Yes, a dumpster arsonist. Very familiar. You're familiar with her because she's the person that's written articles justifying
no-fault divorce. Yeah.
So this is Kaylee Harms is the person who wrote this article. It's called Can Empathy Be Toxic? So it's a play on Ali Stuckey's book, and she does a lot of arguing trying to equate toxic masculinity as a term to toxic empathy?
I mean, let's just even start with why these terms are even in vogue. Why is it called toxic empathy? And that's because the left has been for years using the term empathy as a cudgel. And she'll eventually do the whole empathy versus sympathy debate, which isn't really a real
thing. We'll get into that.
But yeah,
actually, I do think that's a real debate, but she's just wrong on it.
Yeah, but we'll
get into that.
Historically, it's not a real debate, but
actually, I think it is. I got something to show you that'll kind of be interesting. That'll definitely shed some new light on this, because I don't think most people realize the usage of terms. Yeah. Like, no one used the term empathy 100 years ago. No one did. It is a completely astroturf term. And why I'm glad this conversation is being brought up, this debate over empathy is being brought up, is because I think my hypothesis is that empathy is a virtue to an overly feminized society.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you're not going to look at great cultures and say, hey, they valued empathy. No. So that, and, you know, 2020, the whole concept of a struggle session is to use empathy to get people to break down and accept cultural Marxism. That is basic. If you remember 2020, if you can go back to that dark time, during the Black Lives Matter riots, people are like, oh, we need to have conversations about race. Why was it a conversation about race where they share anecdotes, but these anecdotes only have one side of them? They're not admissible in court in any way, shape, or form. They're not even at the level of a signed affidavit. And these anecdotes are meant to tug at your heartstrings to get you to change your perspective on things, because it requires you to turn your logic and thinking, and also the whole biblical standard of, you know, in case one side sounds true until another comes along to cross-examine and stuff like that. So no one's cross-examining these anecdotal evidences. So you're supposed to turn off your thinking and accept that and change your mind and adopt cultural Marxism. That's what those struggle sessions were about in 2020. And that was the usage of empathy.
And part of this is this whole debate is just another instance of the church being behind the culture, because largely you could say the culture has moved on past the empathy debate. And you see this with the attitudes towards Black Lives Matter and all of that. You know, people in 2020 were all gung-ho on Black Lives Matter. And then as they see, you know, the behaviors of, you know, certain communities, they become, you know, white people have become indifferent to the struggle of Blacks. They don't care about, you know, the 13%.
I think it was also Hispanics that hated Black Lives Matter as well.
Well, yeah, but again, that shift has happened. And, you know, whereas Black Lives Matter had favorable approvals well above 50, or, you know, like 50%+, they're now underwater again. And, you know, the tide has completely turned against them, which that's how these things always work. You know, the white people get, you know, they get guilted into sympathizing with Blacks, and then, you know, I guess they experience the consequences of, you know, whether it be the Civil Rights Act, whether it be BLM, once they experience the consequences of, you know, the empathy, so to speak, then they become more apathetic.
So here's where I disagree with you. And that is on the point of the church being behind it. I actually think we're ahead of the culture having this conversation. I think that Joe Rigney and Ali Stuckey, I've not read either of their works yet. But I think they're ahead of the culture on this. I think that they are, because I still think that the term empathy is widely accepted in the culture. I think that we're actually ahead of the conversation on overturning that in the culture, whereas much of the church is behind on the Me Too movement and is still embracing the Me Too movement. You're seeing that a lot of churches are going to be vestiges and holdouts for critical race theory. You saw that with the PCA. We talked about that earlier this week, actually. I did the video on the PCA and how they had their, Blacks only church event, which was, again, pretty off-putting to do that. And it was a not Black church that did that, which kind of made it even weirder. Because I'm not entirely against a, I'm not against black people getting together.
Again, it was exclusionary language because it was a woke church, not a black church.
Yeah.
A black church would have just said, come on out.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, and that's why it was worse. So I think the church is ahead of the curve on the empathy conversation, but we're simultaneously behind on the Me Too movement. I think we're us in Hollywood, because Hollywood's also going to keep on with the critical race theory and the wokeness. The church, there's going to be vestiges of doing that, because that is what agents of Satan are going to do. They're entrenched. But Hollywood, you're seeing Zendaya has just been cast in Shrek 5. So clearly Hollywood is still woke, and they're not. She's also being cast in The Odyssey, which that movie was terrible.
A good joke that she was actually casted for something accurately for once.
Wow. Because it's presumed that she's casted as Shrek's ogre daughter. Yeah. So anyway, I guess voice acting is more her strong suit, because squinting is not acting.
They say a voice for radio.
She writes after bringing up the term toxic masculinity, because that's kind of her hook into the article. The backlash was swift and severe, prompting multiple conservative influencers to write entire books trying to decrying the war on men. That might be a reference to another book. They got so busy arguing the semantics of the term that no one really dug into the substance of the argument that inspired the term in the first place, which is unfortunate. There are very real patterns of behavior among some men that create a lot of suffering, and we do need language to name and confront them. So she's actually justifying the term toxic masculinity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she's, and again, the entire premise of the people arguing against the term was that they were rejecting the core concept. She's basically saying, yeah, the concept exists, but this isn't it, or you guys are just debating semantics, which again is kind of straw man, or, you know, it's not really a specific argument. You're not actually applying names or actual like proofs to it. You're just kind of asserting it, and as if it's a self-evident truth.
Yeah. So she talks about a lot of people screaming toxic masculinity. Most loudly were deeply contemptuous women who are actively hostile to any hint of even healthy manliness. The legitimate grievances were mostly eclipsed by histrionic spokespeople screaming misogyny every time a member of the male species, again, male is not a species, but I get the, I get the colloquialism that she's using, had temerity to express a dissenting opinion on anything from abortion to gun rights.
I'll push back on that, because again, one of the most famous examples of this toxic masculinity push is the Gillette advertising, where the guy wants to cold approach a woman and his bro stops him and like puts the hand on the chest and says, basically, we don't do that. Or it was the Boys Will Be Boys advertisement, where it's just like, yeah, we don't say that anymore. So no, it was not screaming women or necessarily even
corporate America.
It was corporate America. It was Gillette, like, you know, the best a man can get. It was those brands that were most pushing it.
And then she continues, as a lifelong defender of women. Okay, so we know what that means. I myself have lost track of the number of times I've been personally called a men's rights activist or a handmaiden on account of my pro-life views. Indeed, it just induces eye rolls and dismissals. So it's hard to take this article seriously.
I mean, you're arguing with women and then you come away like wanting to be a defender of women.
But. Well, here's the thing. You're arguing with feminists that are to your left, and you're surprised that they view you this way, because
I won't spoil it later on, but you know, she'll bring up the whole 19th Amendment argument, but even though she's just kind of proving your point of why she's proven the entire argument why the 19th is a failure because of the arguments she has to have.
So she's these women. She says, as a general rule, no one is interested in a word you're saying if you yourself are less than healthy or charitable than the rot you condemn.
It's just kind of a I mean, it's kind of a throwaway. I mean,
okay. And then here's where she ties toxic masculinity to toxic empathy. Well, now we're seeing the same principle play itself out in the inverse, but instead of toxic masculinity, the broader discussion is centered on what the right has deemed toxic empathy. So again, reference to Ali Stocky. It might help to pause here at least define our terms. What is empathy and how does it differ from sympathy? So again, this is a completely stupid dichotomy, I think. Whereas empathy can be defined as feeling compassion for someone. Sympathy can be defined as feeling compassion for someone. Empathy is feeling compassion with someone. It's taking their burdens on as your own. So first of all, I even if I want to accept those arguments, I still believe that sympathy is morally superior. And what she goes on to say is Jesus is a prime example of healthy empathy, which I don't think is true because the Bible clearly says that Jesus sympathizes.
Well,
for we do not have a high priest that is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, I believe is what
this is the crux. This is the crux of the semantics here, is because the NIV, another verse of the NIV, changes to say empathizes. I think it is the New King James says sympathizes. I think NASB says sympathize a lot. ESV, I think, is sympathize. And then like KJV is to touch. It has some kind of like touching, but that is a verse that the NIV changed from sympathy to empathy. So again, why did they do that? And I think it's because, you know, this idea of empathy arising, which was not there before.
No, it's a completely fabricated term in many ways. And when you think of, I guess, empath, if you're familiar with Star Trek, the Betazoids can like feel each other. But that's kind of, I guess, that's my opinion of how the term arose, is because of things like Star Trek. But or in sci-fi in general, because I don't think Star Trek invented that in the 90s, but science fiction, empaths, and stuff like that.
And just to clarify, it cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities. So that's the KJV. So those are the three most common interpretations. The most common in modern translations will be sympathize. NIV and the bad translations will change it to empathize. And then the KJV is cannot be touched with.
Right. So we're basically redefining language. We're redefining, we're basically trying to say that feeling compassion for someone is morally inferior to feeling compassion with someone, which is unbridled emotion. That is what it is. The for versus with, I think, is it's not a healthy thing. So I want to share a tab. Here, this is another thing to look at. This is Google Ngrams. So this is a very useful tool in seeing how terms are used over time, just for the audience that's never heard of it. So this is the term empathy. And you can see that this word has basically no usage at all. It maybe pops up a couple times before the 1900s. So before the 20th century, this word doesn't arise at all. Then you see it arise a little bit in the 1930s, and then it takes off from the 1940s onward, and it's parabolic. So this thing just goes way up, and we are at near peak usage, and this goes up to 2021. So 2021 has the highest usage of the term in its history.
So,
and I believe this is relative to the to other words in the English language.
Well, so is this primarily driven by the increase in like psychological literature? Because obviously, you know, especially when you get to like the 70s and stuff, that's when, you know, serial killers become more commonplace in the culture, or so I guess 70s and 80s. But so you have a lot more psychological, I guess, psychologizing of the culture.
I it's hard for me to say what causes this to arise, but my easy catch-all is the post-war consensus plays a role in this. The rapid takeover of feminism of English-speaking societies, I think, plays a role in this. But it's very clear that this is not a term that is natural to Christianity. It's not natural to remove the term sympathy and insert empathy. This is a new term, and it has been weaponized in our culture. You're not going to see the ancients writing about how we need empathy as a culture. You're not going to see that, because that's not what existed back then. So now I'm going to type in sympathy and look at the difference.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
The usage of sympathy, again, it does increase over time. You said, what was it that you said the King James said?
This cannot be touched with.
So, can you read that in the entire verse?
Let me pull it up. We have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like we are, yet without sin.
That's an interesting translation, a little wordier in some ways. So
it just shows you what the Greek language would have been.
Yeah, the usage of sympathy peaks in about 1861. Which American Civil War maybe played a role in that. You see, it does take a dip during World War II, so I'm not sure if war entirely helps out. But yeah, definitely it peaks a little bit in World War I, though. And then it goes up during the, the Civil Rights Movement of the United States. And then it goes down, but now we're up again. So the usage of the word sympathy has a lot more consistency over time, but it does appear to have peaked in the 19th century. Here's another word that I want to add. Charity. Now, this word, interestingly enough, seems to was used a lot in the past. You know, 1600s, it was used. Again, 1800s, word charity is used. And then during the middle of the 1800s, the word sympathy eclipses charity, and which sympathy does get overtaken by charity a little bit until the mid-2000s. And then sympathy is still the most used word of the three. But empathy, again, no usage of that word in the English language. And then 20th century emerges, and all of a sudden this word is become very weaponized in our culture. It's become a value or a virtue to many people, despite the fact that there's no history of this being a Christian virtue.
Now, keep
charity, on the other hand, yes. I think charity is actually is a much more proper term that kind of needs to get reclaimed, and I think it needs to get revitalized, not redefined, but like we need to like get back into using it in its proper context.
Yeah, because it does actually in many ways substitute for love, I think.
Yes, faith, hope, and charity is the King James version, I think, of the virtues. And I actually like that because I think charity is actually an appropriate translation of agape in Greek. Because Oh, here's an interesting one. Unconditional love. This is another term that has no historic usage. So unconditional love, again, no usage whatsoever. And then I think it's like the 80s it picks up. And it's also at its highest. So I think unconditional love is a term that isn't really helpful. It's kind of logically fallacious because, how is God's love? God's love is unconditional, except,
that
it requires the conditions that Jesus died for our sins. We are to repent of our sins. It's not that, we're not given this grace that we can continue to sin, by no means. That's a condition. I believe that there is perseverance of the saints. It's a condition of the love that, we are tasked with persevering till the end.
That's a very marketing term, because unconditional, money back guarantee, it's kind of like, that's kind of the, there's no strings attached. It's kind of like you're applying a lot of marketing language to describe love.
So, I'm trying to catch up on the chat. Let me know if you see some interesting chats to catch up on, but because I was looking at the screen. But it's interesting to see how language changes over time, because I think the unconditional love one is actually pretty interesting. The fact that no one was describing, no one was using this term in Christian parlance, again, prior to, I'm going to peg like Rick Warren's rise or Hillsong's rise, like that era of megachurch Christianity, I feel like. Again, maybe I'm a little premature on that.
Like, it could be Jesus Revolution.
No, it's a little after that. After, I think it's slightly after the Moral Majority.
I mean, this is literature. So, I don't imagine that the hippies were coming up with their books immediately in the 70s.
Early 70s. So Engram uses books and what is.
Yeah, so there is maybe like a bullwhip effect, maybe. Which again, right. The Jesus Revolution does eventually lead to Rick Warren. So it's not like there's no connections between those two.
I think it has more to do with California just being like a cultural hub for the United States. I mean, you got to remember, before Reagan amnesty, California was like what we think of it as Texas now. So you got to, like, California was a very affluent state, predominantly white at the time. And it was basically, land of opportunity for people all across the country to come and live. So there's a lot happening in California. And that's why you got so many megachurch pastors that have risen out of California. Yeah, John MacArthur, David Jeremiah, also California, I think. So Jack Kibbs is California, or is he?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure if he was California or Texas. So, that is a state that's going to produce a lot of megachurches. Texas is now producing a lot of megachurches, so much so that Dallas-Fort Worth had like 3 or 4 megachurch pastor scandals last year. So now Texas is that state. Surprisingly, Oklahoma is kind of a strange megachurch culture as well, because they got Life.Church and they also have Mike Todd. So it's kind of weird. It's like, wow, Oklahoma is not a state you would imagine would be sending mega churches and stuff like that, creating celebrity mega church pastors. But here we are. Although I got to say, I actually do like the movie Jesus Revolution in some ways. Like, I just think the California mega church thing was an inevitability in some respects.
I mean, it's an inevitability of like consumer marketing culture and so forth.
Yeah, but that was what the times were.
Yeah.
What's pretty interesting is that, and I think this is a generational thing, like boomers, we talk a lot about boomers, but Gen Xers are actually the generation that loves credit card debt the most. Fun fact.
Because that was more commonplace in their generation, as far as, they were the ones getting credit cards when, they're like 18 or whatever.
So they're the generation with the highest credit card debt, and it kind of like bell curves out from there. And so a lot of consumerism did happen with that culture. You got the movie Fight Club, which is kind of like a Gen X story in a lot of respects, and which we're not allowed to talk about. And you got things like Radical, which I think is kind of like a Gen X critique of consumerism. So it's kind of interesting, but we can get back on topic now, I guess. But this is really fascinating, the usage of terms in the English language. Empathy is a novel term. And to insert that in a Bible translation, I think is more or less inappropriate. This isn't the whole 1946, we're using the word homosexual now.
Yeah, I mean, again, the more time passes, the more I'm against the idea of copyrighted Bible translations. And so, you know, that way they don't produce them so that they can copyright them. And then, you know, it's just the industrialized Bible is.
Yeah, especially for, was it the Lachman Foundation, and how the latest, you know, NASB Bible is just trash. I think it's 2020 is the year that they did it. It's like, just, you had it with the 1995.
Yeah, everyone loved it.
Everybody loved that translation except for the people that couldn't read. I make a joke, though, about that. ESV is a little bit more controversial, but I saw Ed Stetzer was praising the Christian Standard Bible. I'm like, that's a major L for that translation to have him endorsing it. But anyway, a lot of stuff going on. Back to the article. So she does the whole empathy sympathy thing and argues that empathy is morally superior, and says that Jesus modeled that, even though the Bible uses the word sympathy in most, in a lot of
the good translations,
most of the good translations, it uses the word sympathy, and only bad translations use empathy. So with that said, she says, I personally think they chose the wrong word to describe their concept, but now that it's done and the books have been published and the proverbial die has been cast, I think it's important to consider the message, however clumsily it may have been expressed.
Again, they didn't choose the word chose them.
Yeah, you're right about that for sure. And she says, and I listen and I understand what they're getting at, and they aren't wrong. So this is a quote from Toxic Empathy by Ali Stuckey. Toxic empathy kills. It's not just misleading. It's not just manipulative. It's deadly. Toxic empathy compels a person to have a disproportionate, blinding compassion for whom the media hoist up as the victims, the trans person, the illegal immigrant, the Islamic extremist, then leverages emotion to advocate for horrific policy, self-ID, open borders, protections for grooming gangs, etc. That when we choose feelings over truth, we make very stupid, very dangerous decisions. Your thoughts on that quote by Ali Stuckey?
I mean, it's kind of basic at this point. Obvious, and again, she's contextualizing the whole problem of the moral busybody. You know, I know C.S. Lewis talked about that. So this concept of using empathy or some form of, you know, weaponized compassion is not new. I mean, that's the entire purpose or flaw within humanism, of, you know, trying to do moral works without Christianity, or separate Christ from the works, and to basically just, you know, we're going to make utopian society, and that means caring about the least of us, or even, you know, the liberal concept of the noble savage, where we can make the African or the Indian just another American or a British person. So it's all the same concept. It's just downstream.
I got to read this. Nobody Special sends a super chat $5. Thank you, sir. KJV was good enough for the Apostle Paul, so it's good enough for me. Amen to that.
And again, if you're studying any sort of historic theology, all the books will reference the KJV version of the text.
I'm going to plug myself for a second. Winning Not Winsome, Ten Commandments of Spiritual Warfare, which is also the background of the stream, uses KJV. So, yeah, you can give it to Pastor Jim Bob, and he shall enjoy it. So anyway.
Yeah, because it's not copyrighted.
It's not copyrighted. That's why I used it. And I didn't decide to change it when working with the self-publisher. And
again, to get a copyright, they have to change like, you know, 20% of the Bible. It's, there is a standard.
Yeah. So the problem, so this is Kaylee Harms continuing. She says, the problem Stuckey names are real. Evil political masterminds have weaponized human compassion against the greater good. They've insisted people will die if we don't allow men in women's showers while turning a blind eye to women who say no. They've convinced us that it's cruel to deport illegal immigrants when they commit crime. Just when they commit crimes? Or even when they commit crimes? Because I think crossing the border illegally is already a crime. Anyway, I'll let her finish. And they pay no heed to the rights of victims to be protected. They've convinced us that the only humane way to care for the grape victim is to allow doctors to vacuum her unborn baby from her womb. That's a very outdated way of doing that, but in this pharmaceutical age. Any resistance is met with an immediate label of hater or bigot or misogynist or racist. And it's a pretty effective strategy. No rational person wants to be considered any of those things. Okay, I got a quick story to tell. Like, this happened earlier today. My oldest daughter said, you're a hater. And I think she was, like, playing with something, and she used that phrase. I'm like, I just turned to my wife, was like, who taught her that? And she wanted to blame me for doing that, but it's like, but you're the hater. So, because I say that to my wife, so isn't it her fault that our daughter is picking up on terms that I use? It's very cute, the terms that they're that I use, that they pick up on, or my mannerisms of speaking. It's like, good news. Like, I come into a room saying, I got good news. And they, you know, are now pretending to do that and stuff. So, very cute.
I mean, again, it's a pretty effective strategy. No, it was an effective strategy, and it lost the ballot box. So the era of the Democrats being able to just call people hater, bigot, misogynist, racist, that's over. That lost in 2024. They don't have a strategy. They don't even have the ability to argue. That's how much they've relied on that strategy of just being able to call people bigots and haters, phobes, and whatever else, because that's how they got gay marriage. They just said, oh, you hate gay people. Okay, and rather than do that, people are just like, no, we don't do that. We, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner.
And, not in the Bible.
Yeah, but that's how they got gay marriage. They just browbeated people by calling them racist and phobes and all that. That's how BLM got so much cultural cachet.
Well, wasn't there a certain judge who couldn't say no to their relative or like the...
Yeah, that had a conflict of interest and ruled it, which again was, that's, you know, the story of California going blue is not just Reagan amnesty. It's the fact that the voters repeatedly voted conservative and then the judicial activists overturned the will of the people, which then solidified it as a blue state.
Yeah, it was a Proposition 8 at the time, and it was Chuck Norris approved, and they
Prop 8 was gay marriage. Then in the 90s, you had basically the no sanctuary city. I mean, I think it was like, we're not going to give any benefits to illegals, and the judges overturned that. So, the Democrats don't have an argument, and that's part of the whole, the left is really defeated, and they either have the choice of doubling down on the gay stuff or, you know, what I believe will be the pivot into neoconservatism, but they don't have a strategy right now, and they don't have a message against Trump. And, you know, that's part of the effect of Trump's blitzkrieg strategy or shock and awe. So, yeah, I mean, it was an effective strategy, but it's not anymore. And, you know, the fact that she doesn't even realize this when writing the article, it just shows her ability to analyze the culture is...
Well, I think she's trying to bring in a... So Ali Stuckey, I think, is getting at the root of the issue. Like, now we're getting into the technical... we're watching the game tape, right? So in the game, the terms hater or bigot or misogynist or racist, they've lost their power, and it showed in the game film. Now we're analyzing the game film and saying these are tools of weaponized empathy, and we need to actually recalibrate our thinking on this concept for the next game. So that's why I think we're actually a little bit ahead of the culture on this debate. I think, and the other thing is, we're also ahead of the culture on the critical race theory issue. Not just Evangelical Dark Web, which, yes, but it was us fighting in the church, critical race theory and wokeness, that got Donald Trump to champion the issue. He retweeted, but, you know, Tom Askell in 2020 on this issue. And that's when Trump started to take this issue on. And that's when Republicans in general, we made it a partisan issue, which was better than it being a bipartisan issue against us. So I want to catch up on some chat. Nobody special with another super chat. Thank you, sir. Ask any person in the USA to quote John 3:16, and they will quote it in the King James. I don't know if that's true or not.
But I guess it's the only begotten son.
Yeah, that is pretty King
James. That word.
Did you see my comment? Empathy, I think, is a valid concept. Weep with those who weep seems like empathy, but it's tethered to the local Christian community. And I might say that's more sympathy than empathy.
That might, because again, unless you're like the people that are, you know, that are both weeping because they have the exact same situation happen to them, then that's what's considered empathy, not sympathy. But I mean, again, her entire ability to understand how politics has become gendered. And if masculine politics is winning, if strongman politics is winning, then the idea of just calling people haters, bigots, misogynists, and phobes, or whatever else, is not an effective strategy anymore.
And then continuing with the article, Harms writes, toxic empathy is just a name they've given to describe weaponized emotional blackmail. And maybe that's true for Ali Stuckey. I don't think that's going to be true for Joe Rigney, who seems to frame empathy as a counterfeit to compassion. Again, his book is very vague in its description. I've not watched any interviews he's done on it yet.
But in terms of
looking at the,
And he does go into the distinction of the Hebrews 4:15. I believe, or at least in the interviews he has. So I believe his book will do that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because as far as like nerding out on Bible translations, I also think it was a mistake for things like the ESV, for instance, to use the term for the word for homosexual to then say Paul's describing the sin twice in the Greek instead of effeminacy. Like King James, I think, uses effeminacy. The NASB 95 uses effeminacy, and then the NASB 2020 goes with the ESV and the NIV. I think the NIV does that also. Even though Paul uses the term artisan koine, whatever.
Or man better.
Man better is really what it means. And he uses that term in 1 Timothy 1 and doesn't use the other term. So he's not being redundant. Then she says, conservatives keep screaming about, are we there yet? No.
There are.
But that's not actually empathy, the left retorts. Empathy is good. Empathy is important. Empathy is what differentiates healthy people from sociopaths. It should be encouraged, not demonized. There are, of course, toxic applications of both masculinity and empathy, and it's right to name them. But both sides are skillfully avoiding dealing with the actual content of the argument by constructing a semantical war against the terminology. And maybe we're mounting a semantical war against the terminology because this terminology has like infiltrated common English parlance in the last few decades, and the results have been bad.
Well, I mean, okay.
Maybe that's why.
Well, we are fighting a war with words. So words are themselves the weapon. You know, the pen is mightier than the sword. Well, it's not exactly like we're using swords and guns to fight this war. So, yeah, we're going to fight over the words.
The concept of fifth generation warfare, which is, I believe, touched up on the introduction of Winning Not Winsome, is about the omnipresence of the battlefield. And that is very true for spiritual warfare. It is an omnipresent battlefield, and words matter for this. Defining our terms.
Information is the weapon.
Yes, it often is.
So yes, the word choice matters.
Knowledge is power. Let's see. So she's trying to, again, she goes back to equating toxic masculinity with toxic empathy. And she says, conservative Christians keep screaming about toxic empathy. Progressive Christians keep crying foul when they do. Progressive Christians, pretty interesting that she uses that term unironically. And then she says, both sides of this are right. When empathy is weaponized to the degree that we are chemically castrating our children in the name of compassion, we've got a major problem. Progressives dismiss the weight of this to their peril. But it's also unfortunate. So she's about to go into, she's about to attack some friendlies here. But it's also unfortunate reality that many people screaming toxic empathy are most loudly, not Ali Betts. So she's trying to say, oh, I'm not talking about Ali Stuckey. It's Ali Stuckey. Can we stop saying Ali Betts Stuckey?
I mean, can we, anyway, this is also just the feminism. I'm not talking about my fellow sister over there. No, I'm talking about all those men. Again, yeah. This is a and blame the men.
No,
this
no,
is,
it's not just a blame the men. Oh. Megan Basham gets thrown under the bus too. Are working overtime to eliminate empathy entirely. These are loveless, graceless, pharisaical tyrants who want to bring back blasphemy laws and execute post-abortive women and return the vote to only landowning males. And then she just says you'll find him on social media and all over the world wide web. Is that a mask off moment? That's a mask off moment right there.
Yeah. I mean, where in the Bible does it say that you have the right to vote in a civic polity? No verse. Even the concept of voting is not really in the Bible in any positive.
Yeah, we can come up with some negative caucusing events like the Rebellion of Korah in the Old Testament, Book of Numbers. So I mean, that was sort of a caucus that occurred. Everyone who's with the rebellion, please gather.
I mean, yeah, there might be a republic in a sense, because that's generally what they like in the period of the judges and the elders coming together as a senate or a parliament. That's been used throughout history. But again,
because the judges were effectively kings.
Yes, but the elders did rule as well.
Yeah, it was a complicated and undefined system of government. But the judges ruled as kings. Like Gideon ruled as a king. Then his son Abimelech made himself king. So Gideon was essentially a king. He's a proto-king for all intents and purposes. Abimelech made himself king, lasted about 3 years. But a lot of the judges pretty much ruled as kings. Not Samson, though. I don't think he ever really ruled as a king, but I think the judge after him kind of did. But I'm going through the Book of Judges with my children, so I'm very fresh on it. But these judges did rule as kings.
Well, my point being that, you know, the idea of consent of the governed being in the scriptures has to do with God inaugurates the king and then the people ceremoniously recognize the king.
Yeah,
this happens with Saul. This happens with David. So even though David's anointed, he's not necessarily king until he is recognized by the people, inaugurated by the people.
Right. And I guess that's the pattern we see in Judges as well.
So that's the most, that is the most of civic participation you see in the Bible, is the people recognize what God does and affirm the decision.
So here we go. We're about to get saucy right now. There's a kernel of important truth at the foundation of their message, that which is why it resonates with people. Behind the curtain, there's no hint of Christ-like compassion in any of their objectives. So, and progressives can smell this a mile away. So again, she thinks being pro-prosecution on the issue of abortion is not empathetic, and I would agree with that, but it is just. It is righteous.
Well, again, you don't need
which
to
is be- a higher principle than empathy.
For the idea of criminalization to be punished, you wouldn't even need to do death penalty. But again, she would object to like a 1 year prison sentence or, you know, 10. How about 10 lashes across the back and then you're free to go? Like she would probably object to that, even though, you know, you're not losing your life.
Yeah. I mean, she's against that. They are against any punishment.
Yes. So it's not even
like
the
Kristen
most...
Hawkins, who I think, like, I have to imagine, like, the way she argues, I feel like she's had an abortion before. I don't know her story, so, but the way she argues, it sounds like she's had an abortion.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea.
And she blames a man on it. So that's why if she doesn't actually cop to it, then.
Well, but again, you see the idea.
It wasn't her that had it.
I mean, my entire argument on like why the pro-life movement is ineffective is because it's ran by women. A lot of these women have had abortions. So again, that empathy is literally losing ballot issue after ballot issue and getting
now,
absolutely nothing done.
Credit to Abby Johnson, who is actually right on this issue.
So. Sure, but she shouldn't be leading the pro-life movement.
I don't think she actually is. I think Lila Rose and Kristen Hawkins are the de facto leaders of the pro-life movement.
Certainly, as far as the
Abby Johnson, I'm not sure what she's doing in the movement. Like, I don't know what organization she's with that is wielding considerable lobbying influence. But that's not true of Students for Life or Live Action and these other outlets. So here we go. Shots are fired at the Christian nationalist crowd. Pastor, chauvinist, and anti-Semite extraordinaire, which you don't have to capitalize, by the way. Joel Webbin would be the prime example of this. He loudly trumpets a talking point about how the sin of empathy is the reason why we allowed cities to burn in 2020, etc. And this became a meme all last week. I did a few things like this. But the sin of empathy becoming a meme of why... insert bad event, but Joe Webbin's absolutely right in seriously, not just in a meme sense, about tying it to the riots of 2020. He's absolutely right about that. Because riots are the voice of the unheard, according to MLK, the patron saint of wokeness. So, but for men like Joel, it's a very convenient thing indeed to categorize empathy as a sin. As long as it's sinful, they don't have to do any work to try to manufacture it in their own lives, and it saves them the trouble of faking it. What's worse is that they openly salivate over the prospect of seeing people they dislike suffer. It's as if the parts of scripture where Jesus commands us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us simply doesn't exist in their paradigms. I just got to say on that last part, does the Bible not talk trash on the suffering of God's enemies? Let's use Jezebel. She, I believe, falls out of a window and is eaten by dogs. That is the Bible. That is God just absolutely reveling and enjoying in perhaps the suffering of Jezebel.
No, I mean, again, there's countless, how many Psalms deal with the concept of God's enemy suffering or David having victory? Again, military victory. So that does imply the suffering of the of people that are your enemies. But I think it's what Psalm 109. I mean, you know, you get a lot of those Psalms, the ones that talk about how, you know, Egyptian chariots were washed in the Red Sea. I mean, yeah, the suffering of your enemies is not something that is praised in the Psalms. I mean, David is likened to Christ because of how he fights for his church. So that comparison of David being a Christ type is, again, historic understanding of Christianity, which this woman would have no understanding of, which, you know, that's her entire life is devoted to being antithetical to history. But, you know.
Yeah. So I honestly, at the end, she does describe herself as a Christian feminist. I don't think history is her strong suit. Or take Joe Rigney. So we've talked about Joe Rigney and made reference to his book, Sin of Empathy. Do look forward to reading it. I have a large reading stack at the moment because I just got Andrew Torba's book as well. And that book looks kind of thick. It looks a little intimidating for me. I'm not going to lie. His book is titled The Sin of Empathy. Unless you be tempted to write it off as a fringe effort. First of all, this guy is being published by Canon Press. So,
man, he's like Doug Wilson's.
They're a traditional publisher.
Right, not quite right hand, but yes.
I thought that was Jared Longshore.
Well, Joe Rigney's in the. He's the guy that left John Piper's world, right?
He also didn't sign the Antioch Declaration. So, shout out. Anyway, he says, you just know that this past week, he interviewed Al Mohler, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This is no small thing. Doesn't she mean that Al Mohler interviewed him?
I don't know. What, I don't know the reference.
Does she not?
He might have had her. Like, I don't know if it's Joe Rigney. He had interviewed and had Al Mohler, or Al Mohler had a podcast and interviewed. And again, Christian Post didn't even link it.
They linked something. Yes, it's Al Mohler's Thinking in Public. So again, that's just bad writing there. No, Al Mohler interviewed him, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, political chameleon extraordinaire Al Mohler. So again, very misleading on the text there in the syntax. So this is no small thing. I actually agree with this. The SBC is the largest Protestant denomination on the planet, and the presidents of their seminary set the tone for the all-male pastors who emerged from the ranks. That's
unfortunately.
Because Southern Baptist Theological Seminary does produce female pastors.
Yeah, did Christian Post add that in post or something? But
no.
Yeah. That's BS, given that the SBC seminaries create women pastors.
This interview creates legitimacy where it should expel an immoral brother. What? So he's a brother, but he's immoral and should be expelled?
Notice that she doesn't actually make the case of what he did that's immoral. His sin was writing the books, The Sin of Empathy.
Which you've not read.
Yeah, which she hasn't read. She has no arguments read it. From.
I pre-ordered it.
It just came out. And again, she's trying to make a determination that he's unqualified. Again,
and then she goes after, are we serious? I'm going to click on this link again. She's upset that, okay, so Megan Basham said, nothing gives me more pleasure right now than the high-pitched screaming that comes with quarters because Joe Rigney's work is being given the serious consideration it deserves. It's a new day in evangelical political thought, and I'm grateful for it. So people really got on Megan Basham for this. Let me actually hit the like button on that. And Kaylee Harms cannot stand this. She cannot abide this. When dozens of Christians reach out to Al Mohler to express their concerns with his decision to platform Rigney, so she has it right this time, journalist Megan Basham chimed in with a gobsmackingly mean-spirited response.
I mean, just the word gobsmackingly.
Yeah, that's a good adverb she used there.
I would say it's actually not, but it kind of discredits her argument.
I was being sarcastic.
Okay, yeah. It makes it seem very emotional.
You know what's even worse than toxic empathy? A psychopathic absence of empathy, and it's all done in God's name. It's evil. The Bashams and the Rigneys of the world are serving the same function as the histrionic man-haters denouncing toxic masculinity, and they're making it really hard for outsiders to even consider the conversation at all. Does she sound hysterical?
She's the one that's hysterical. Yeah. I mean, again, you can't out-emote the left. I mean, this is the whole logic versus feelings in the whole, Ben Shapiro, facts don't care about your feelings, even though, you're not going to convince these people with facts because they only care about their feelings and, their own selves in a sense, because it's just individualism. But yeah, the idea, and, there's the whole debate of whether the right should work on, a emotional argument, which. Yes and no. I mean, the fact is you can't out-emote the left, but you can appeal to,
natural affections.
Yes, natural affections. Or what is a nation? Because again, you're not winning elections based on who has the better tax plan. You're winning elections based on whether you can get your people, your demographics, to turn out and check a box.
Basically, it's a turnout election, base election. And Trump has won because he's appealing to America. He's appealing to nationalism, which Mitt Romney and John McCain were anti-nationalists. They were globalists.
And he ran a masculine campaign.
Especially this time around.
Yes. That was a male-centric campaign. That was a, I'm a man. And again, he did this before, Megan
He went to Joe Rogan. He went to all the podcasts. And
a lot of those efforts were already underway before the Kamala switch. So it's not like, you know, Kamala being hyper feminine was the reason Trump went hyper masculine. That, I mean, yeah, the divergence really split off, but you know, those seeds were already sown. You know, it was the white boy summer memes that stoked the energy, that kept a lot of the fire going. So yeah, Trump ran a masculine campaign. He didn't necessarily focus too much on the arguments, except, you know, aside from the basics. But again, the energy was masculinity. And again, that people like Megyn Kelly were like, it's too brocastic. He's going to lose women. And, you know, he wins 60% of white men.
Yeah, and now the New York Times is writing articles about what I'm calling the bro revival. I shared the term with my pastor, and he liked the term bro revival. So it's going to catch on. We're going to call it the bro revival. Now the New York Times wrote an article recently about the bro revival, and that made the rounds this morning. At least a screenshot did. I'll probably write an article on that, Evangelical Dark Web. Hit that subscribe to the newsletter after you subscribe to the channel.
And before you think, oh, it's just the New York Times, it's liberal media. No, they're using Pew Research data. They're using actual hardcore data, or at least the best societal data we have, as far as like, you know, macro. Like It's like the second best data we have to like the U.S. Census.
There's a lot of stuff happening right now. And Nicole Shannon getting baptized, that's something praiseworthy as well. That, you know, God can convince the liberal Jewish lady to become a Christian. Like, that is a miracle. That is a miracle. You got to understand how hardcore hardness of heart exists in that community.
No, I mean, she wasn't. I don't know. So. She was always Jewish, but you know. Read my article. I wrote a whole thing on it.
Yes. Okay. I edited the article, but sometimes editing versus reading comprehension, there's a disconnect. My bad. Anyway. And this is unfortunate because toxic masculinity is not no masculinity. It's the solution to toxic masculinity is not no masculinity, is virtuous masculinity. And the solution to toxic empathy is not no empathy. It's empathy rightly surrendered to the truth and lordship of Jesus Christ. And what about the term sympathy? I would say sympathy is morally superior, but that's not with someone enough. Anyway. Ironically, the entire debate seems to mirror the political war between the sexes when the right likes to demonize women, and specifically feminists. Gee, I wonder why. As the bane of society and primary source of toxic empathy, the left, in turn, meaning they're doing this as a result, as a reaction to, lay all the blame of the world's ills squarely on the shoulders of white conservative men. Again, they did that first.
Yeah, she has it completely backwards.
And so the battle rages on, with everyone pointing fingers and refusing to contend with the rot in their respective camps. First of all, how can the liberals contend with the rot in their camps? It's all rot.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, even the so-called black church is all rot.
I feel like
and that Pew Research data points to it very, very well when you look at like the black church's attitudes on things like abortion or even just nationalism. Like national identity.
I got some articles coming out about that Pew Research thing, but that being said, there is probably more righteous men in Sodom than in the Democrat Party. Let's just be real. Contrary to popular opinion, none of these problems will be resolved by raging against masculinity or eliminating women's right to vote. Actually, I think a lot of problems would be solved.
Literally, you could solve every problem, but, you know, banking and usury, you know, the war machine and Zionism, and maybe like, you know, I don't know, maybe one or two other issues. Like, you're left with your final boss fights. But as far as like all the cultural rot, the culture war stuff, that's all eliminated if you get rid of the 1920s. Yeah.
Progressives won't win by emasculating men. Actually, that's the only way they can win this.
Well, that's...
is by emasculating men. The only way they can win is to emasculate men. That's what they did all... That's what they've been doing for decades, really.
I mean, that's literally... I mean, the problem is that strategy isn't working anymore. And of course, it, you know...
You're running out of men that are subject to being emasculated. Yeah, like, listen to David French. That dude sounds completely emasculated. Just saying.
I mean, again,
and a lot of liberal dudes look like lesbians as they get older. Completely emasculated. So they do win by emasculating men, but the bros are being rescued from being emasculated.
I think the political divergence. Again, that's because that's their entire strategy, was to just browbeat men. They hate, again, their entire coalition, the entire leftist coalition, is branded by hating white men. And yes, with an emphasis on Christianity, but not exclusive. Because again, there is a spiritual element that, because a person's history or culture was historically Christian, therefore that has to be destroyed as well.
And then he says, Theobros won't win this by further subjugating and silencing women. The word further is another feminist denotation, because again, I would say we live in a gynocratic society. So there have been no checks on feminism since its inception, or since its popularization in the American politic.
Trump getting rid of DEI is like the biggest win against feminism, I don't know, since the 60s. The idea of getting rid of affirmative action, getting rid of feminism, and hopefully that can trickle down into the military. So yeah, that is the biggest win against feminism since the onset.
So I would actually agree that we won't win by taking away the right of women to vote, because I think we're going to have to win way before that ever.
Yeah. By the time you
serious political possibility.
Yeah. By the time you even get there, you've already won quite a bit of battles.
We will win by mass deporting illegal aliens, a moratorium on immigration, and preventing grooming in the public schools. And then Democrat Party, as it exists now, will be doomed.
And the money, and stopping the NGO money.
That funds all this cultural stuff. We don't actually need to. It's interesting. Like, we actually might not need to do that as soon as I would have thought. That's something we can do way down the road. Because you're right. The NGO money is a great point, because that's the liberal patronage network. We are funding our own degeneracy in our society and even societies abroad, which then in turn comes back to us. There's blowback. So we actually we can win by shutting that down. Like, that's a huge win, because wokeness in the church, a lot of it was government subsidized.
Well, I mean, let's just get to the silencing women part. Yeah, I mean, if the Southern Baptist Convention had just ignored the whining women, they would be avoiding a lot of the pitfalls that they're experiencing right now. They wouldn't be having their guy, Jeff Org, who we talked about last week, talking about needing to borrow, or really just take, $3 million from the cooperative program to fund their lawsuits. Like,
he's already taken loans. Well, now he's talking about taking money, just to be clear.
So, I mean, yeah, had they just ignored the whining women, then we wouldn't be in this situation.
But that's also why the Southern Baptist Convention refuses to take a biblical position on abortion and being pro-prosecution. I'm going to use the term pro-prosecution. That is a label that Kristen Hawkins, I think, coined, and I think we should rock it, because that is a beautiful term. Yes, pro-prosecution.
Again, it does, speak to a failure in congregational polity of, should women be on church committees, or should churches even have committees when they have elders and deacons, the only two offices ordained in the church? And of course, the big story this week about the Southern Baptist Convention Credentials Committee, apparently you don't need to be qualified as a pastor to be on a Southern Baptist committee, which is basically, a church synod.
Yeah, so, or
you don't need to very meet the low. You don't need to meet qualifications for a pastor in order to judge whether a church is in friendly cooperation or not,
or like, to know what a pastor is.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And again, and even the idea of, like, should women be allowed to vote in church, like elections or church votes? I mean, again,
I actually don't think I don't really think that's a problem, because if that is a problem, it would manifest itself as a problem. The thing is, most church votes are overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean,
so I don't see it as a functional problem.
I mean, I guess we're just pointing out the problems of congregational governance.
Well, here's the thing. I think the body of Christ should be in unity on most voting issues. Like, my church approved the budget. It was a pretty unanimous vote. There weren't any questions about it at the meeting, because I guess we hashed all those questions out last year and everything is just inflationary adjustments. And, you know, it was hashed out the previous year and a little bit more, I don't want to say fireworks because it wasn't dramatic really, but I get entertainment from parliamentary meetings and stuff. Business meetings can be entertaining to me. So anyway, I'll finish the article. And the truth will only be found by those who are willing to forego tribalism and wrestle in the gray areas in the middle of the extremes. So,
I mean, it's just a rejection of natural law and natural hierarchy.
Kaylee Harms is the co-founder of Hands Across the Aisle Women's Coalition, a Christian feminist who rarely fits into boxes. She's a truth teller, envelope pusher, Jesus follower, abuse survivor, writer, wife, mom, and lover of words aptly spoken, like God smackingly, right? Anyway, that is the article for tonight.
I mean, technically tribalism is the future. You got to know who you are, know who your people are, and then actually stand up for your people.
Yeah. So what do you think? We got enough time for meme review?
Oh, we always have time for meme review.
Oh, we always got time for meme review. All righty, let's do some meme review. And actually, let me catch up on, I saw a chat. Do the super chat. Nobody special says, am I the only one worried about Christless conservatism in this administration? Am I being extra? So
I'm assuming this is in reference partially, at least in part, to Kash Patel swearing his oath on some something. Pagan book that was, you know, not the most famous book that come out of India, because that would be the Kama Sutra. So it's something secondary to that.
I don't even know. Like, Hinduism is not a unified religion, so I'm not even sure if it's a big deal.
I understand the apathy or the skepticism regarding, like, you know, a lot of these godless people and conservative movement. I mean, it's probably worse if you look at, you know, Congress with all the ethots that are elected into Congress, or even Conservative Inc., where, you know, ethots are hired and, you know, you can do sex work and get a job in Conservative Inc. So, I mean, it is certainly everywhere, and then it trickles into the administration. I mean, Kash Patel is kind of a creature of the swamp. If you're looking at that as one example, but I mean,
here's the thing. When you have a movement, there's a significant portion of Christians in the Trump administration. There's also a significant portion of Christless conservatives in the Trump administration. We're going to compete for the influence of the overall movement. And it's going to be imperative to fight for this. This is a great question. Definitely something I've been writing about, actually. I have an article in the works on Christless conservatism.
And keep in mind,
it works for like a month, but it's not time sensitive enough.
And keep in mind, Elon Musk is his own faction. And then you have the Christian, you know, the white evangelicals teamed up with Elon Musk. And then that helped put Trump over the line. But I mean, it was in politics, you know, the coalition did form, and those are two factions of the coalition. So Elon Musk is his own faction. He obviously, because he's part of the coalition, he gets seats at the table. Then you get people like Kash Patel who are, you know, swamp creatures to some people, swamp creatures, but he's our swamp creature, so to speak. And, you know, I guess, you know, obviously he's running the FBI, swearing on a pagan book, not very good, but at the end of the day, I'm just going to look at what the results are. And again, you know, you saw this again with the cabinet meeting that you had, you know, I guess a lot of idiots complaining about, oh, Trump, God doesn't hear Trump's prayer. Well, even though it was the housing and urban development guy,
there's a pastor.
Yeah. And the guy has like 9 kids or something like that. So it's literally like the stereotypical, like, large Christian family guy that was the one making the prayer. So, I mean, there are, you know, still good Christians in the administration.
Yeah. And again, we're going to be vying for influence, and we got to stay vigilant in the fight. Good question. And thank you for the super chat. Let's do some meme review. Brought to you by Evangelical Dark Web. We have no sponsors. Other Paul with this meme, corporate needs you to define the difference between this picture and it's a Cody Lawrence guy and PC principal from South Park, and says they're the same picture. Is this true? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I like the meme because it is kind of the whole, you know, he does kind of put off the I'm the tough guy thing with the, I guess, the bad album. The bad album cover. I made the joke underneath this tweet that it's just like, this is going to be the next, you know, liberal hive mind buzzword, because they're trying to say that, or this Cody Lawrence dude was saying that midwit was apparently now some
term.
It's a new term that the right is using, even though it's been used on the internet for like 10 plus years.
This guy is the Rip Van Winkle of anti-Christian nationalist. So, somebody gets that reference. All right. We got this team, this meme from Benaya Ariel. Make abortion. And I love this meme template. I got to say, because you know me, I love SpongeBob memes. Love SpongeBob in general. This is from the Health Inspector episode. I think it's the Nasty Patty is the name of the episode. Make abortion unthinkable. And it has the scene where he's choking on a fly. And then make abortion a capital crime. And that is the dignified dining. So I like that. Another SpongeBob meme made it. This is Joshua, who says dead saints when people pray to them. And it's the beginning of the SpongeBob theme song. It's like, I can't hear you.
Oh, so he's good.
I thought that was masterful.
Catholic humor.
Again, I'm not. Actually, as far as criticisms of Catholicism go, the whole praying the saints thing is like very down the list. But I loved this meme, so it made the list. Here we go. Some anti-Joel Berry stuff. This is Joel Berry trying to it's the whole round shape and a square hole thing.
No.
And in this case, he's trying to put a star of Rephrim in a cross-shaped hole. So it's not going to work. And he's drooling because he's, I guess, brain dead. We got Wade Stotts from The Wade Show with Wade, who's honestly, I think he could be the next Doug Wilson in a good way.
I mean, he, unlike Jeff Gerben, he could actually pull off a late night format.
I think he could, because he also has experience on
Steve. Yeah, but his monologue is the same as like a late night. Yeah. So he could actually pull it off.
Yeah, I think he could. And he says, and it has Alan Rickman from Reacher, right? That's his show.
No, it's his name Rickman. No, it's
Alan Rick. I'm sorry, that's what's his face?
That's Severus Snape or Hans Gruber.
And what's his name again? It's Alan, right?
I forget.
Rickman Richardson.
I forget, but I don't actually know what happens in the show that like is. Like instigating all the memes against Reacher, because again, Reacher is the most mediocre of mediocre shows.
Okay, Reacher, and apparently the guy goes super liberal in this season. Is like, excuse me, did you just deny climate change? And he's, I guess, this is actually like PC Principal's character in South Park, where he just is a menace over political correctness, where he uses like masculine energy to ironically advocate for effeminate policies and stuff like that. And there's another meme like it. I think you mean Elliot Page, and he's like choking someone.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what happens on the show that is instigating all these memes. It does reflect his personality and his real life. And yeah, because it's an Amazon show, people. But yeah, the show is so mediocre. Like even season one sucks. The Tom Cruise movies were so much better.
It's Tom Cruise.
Yeah, but it's, you know, so, you know, turn your brain off.
And it's this guy whose name I can't remember.
And the show, the actual seasons themselves are basically just movies stretched out like 3 to 4 hours that don't need to be 3 to 4 hours.
So he says, I think that's Elliot Page. Because supposedly, according to the memes, he says Black Lives Matter. I don't know. That's according to the memes. I could be wrong about that. We got one from Jessup Pyrie. I don't know. Pyrie's Patriarch is the handle. Leftist hate tactics and Joel Berry bashing the brethren. Corporate needs you to find the difference between this picture and this picture. It's the same picture. Another office meme there. And then this one from McDougal. It's a Scooby-Doo mask off meme with the, let's see who's hiding underneath the Joel Berry mask, and it's Phil Vischer. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it does speak to the whole, where do you get your talking points from? And, you know, in this case, Phil Vischer.
Yeah, it wasn't James Lindsay.
Yeah, it wasn't, which is who Cody Lawrence gets his talking points from.
Yeah. We got Eschatology Matters. What if I told you dispensationalism is the real replacement theology? That is from The Matrix.
Not as good, because it is kind of an oldie, but a goodie, you know, as far as like an argument.
Yeah, it's not like,
it's not a fresh argument or novel. It doesn't have that, you know, you really laid, you know, you didn't really give me something I haven't seen before.
Fair enough. Then we got the Predator handshake meme, where federal agencies and conservative ethos are bonding or shaking hands over getting penetrated by Elon. That hurts because it's true.
See, yeah, that's the Christless conservatism you get, is the fact that, you know.
Both of those in many ways. Here we go. Natural Law Theonomist has the meme of the, was the painter's name John Harris or Jonathan Harris?
I don't know, but it was a black guy where James White's face is over.
They white faced him.
It's hilarious because it's funny on its own. Like, there's so much, like, this is almost a simulacrum of, a perfect simulacrum of jokes, because you're now like several degrees separated from the original picture of like the black family or whatever being painted over by a white guy with the black. No,
it was civil rights heroes, not a family
or something like that. But
instead it's Doug Wilson getting painted over with the case for Christian nationalism by Stephen Wolf, and James White is upset about it. Oh, that is perfection. Like
this guy was laying it on nice. That's very well done. You put a lot of time into that.
Was it Trump's presents his pick to lead the Gaza rebuild, and it's what's his face? Baldwin the leper.
Yeah, I'm not seeing Kingdom of Christ or whatever, or
Kingdom of Heaven. Hear it's not good.
Yeah, I hear it's not good, even though the memes are good. Though there is a true point in the whole Gaza thing where I don't actually think it's real. And a lot of people were reacting about the Trump posting the AI slop video, which, again, I don't really care about, even though, yeah, there's some weird images in there because it's AI that generated it. But, you know, it's probably not a big nothing burger, and it's just Trump trying to get the Middle East on board with the Gaza situation while also insulting Israel, because he's basically saying if Gaza belongs to America, then that means that they don't have a claim to that land.
Yeah. So. It's ironically an anti-Zionist action by Trump, because it, by definition, he's taking away land claims. And according to dispensationalism, he's inviting the wrath of God by doing that. So anyway, I'll do a last call for questions. That being said, check out Evangelical Dark Web. We got a daily news every day. So we have a newsletter. We got a Patreon-like system that you can support us, get bonus access to bonus content. I got some interesting ideas for bonus content coming up. I fixed the newsletter so where there's a link at the bottom of the newsletter to take you to the bonus content section. So I've added that to the newsletter because they are not appearing in the RSS feed. So I fixed that. I'm a little tech savvy sometimes. Anyway, another thing about Trump is I think he's also doing really well in foreign policy with the Ukraine thing. Like, if we can get half of Ukraine's natural resources out of the deal by backing a losing side of a proxy war, like that's somewhere America there. That's better than nothing. Anyway, you got anything coming up in the articles?
No, not as of right now.
I should totally get on you for that. Evangelical Dark Web, we do actually support and pay writers for articles and stuff like that. So Anthony included. Not much, but better than nothing, because there's a certain Christian outlet, a certain Christian podcast that put a job listing out there for volunteer writers. I'm like, And if it's exceptional, they'll grace you with being present on their podcast. I just thought that was kind of greedy. It rubbed me the wrong way. And I didn't even look for this. I just stumbled upon it. I'll read this super chat. Thank you, Bishop of the Railway. We did it, Patrick. We got Hegseth appointed Moscow 2020.
Which I'm assuming is the Bikini Bottom Burning meme. That's where you're going with that.
Again, I love SpongeBob memes, and I do like SpongeBob. Good to watch with the whole family. Interestingly enough, it actually is. Like, I thought, oh no, we're at the point where the episodes start to taper off. I'm like, no, we just did the invisible paint episode. I'm like, that's a banger. It stains clothes.
Yep, that was the joke the entire time.
Anyway, I didn't see any questions coming. Thank you all for a good stream. Have a blessed night. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.